and this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Prohibition took away legal alcohol in America, but brought with it opportunity for clever criminals, including George Remus, who built his bourbon empire with feet on both sides of the Ohio River. He lived in a grand mansion in Price Hill. He later died in the care of a nurse in Covington. But his rise to criminal power is a story worth knowing, and local author Bob Batchelor offers his attempt in The Bourbon King, The Life and Crimes of George Remus, Prohibition's Evil Genius. Batchelor speaks on Thursday at the Newport Syndicate from 7 to 9 p.m. in an event produced by the Campbell County Public Library titled Booze and Bootlegging, The Life and Crimes of George Remus. The story of Remus's life of love, his wife, murder, also his wife, and extravagance, and his nationwide bourbon empire are the focus of the book and the presentation. So joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about the book is author Bob Batchelor. Bob, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
Absolutely. This book is really well written. I enjoyed the way that you captured the story and the way that you told it. You set some dramatic scenes and built some suspense. And honestly, my first question here about George Remus is, how in the heck has his life never been made into like a movie that only focuses on him?
Michael, you've hit the major question everybody asks me. It's the number one question. How do I not know this? Why isn't it on Netflix or Amazon? So I don't know the exact reason, because he was a character in Boardwalk Empire,
right,
but the character was a joke. He was the clown of Boardwalk Empire.
He referred to himself in the third person a lot.
Yeah,
which
Remus did. He did it for effect because he was very modest about the fact that he didn't have education. And so he thought that by referring to himself in the third person, it would elevate him, because he's hanging out and going up against, as a lawyer, some of the best attorneys in America. So he's always trying to elevate himself. And I don't know why it's not been made into a film at this point, but certainly I can't really talk about it. But there's some people talking on the other side of the country about this.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. I hope you'll keep us posted about those other people on the other side of the country, because I just can't believe this. As you get into just the criminal nature, bootlegging in general is very interesting to people, but this involves, you know, the story of an immigrant who starts in pharmacy, then becomes a lawyer, and then gets into the criminal underworld, but also kills his wife in Eden Park here in Cincinnati. I love the scene where he's a practicing lawyer defending someone accused of poisoning someone else. In fact, I want to ask you to set the scene for our listeners, because I won't do it justice. He's there in the courtroom pleading to the jury on behalf of his client. He's got the alleged poison, which is apparently actual poison.
It is actual poison.
In the courtroom, has the skull and crossbones on it. He shows them, and then tell our audience what he did.
Well, Remus does the unthinkable. He picks that poison up before anybody can react, and he drinks it down. And a gasp is obviously let out in the courtroom. The jury is up in arms. Everybody, I mean, it's just helter-skelter in there. And it's right as his closing argument ends. So the jurors are shuffling out of the room, and they keep looking back because they're waiting for Remus to fall over dead. And they go away. They realize Remus isn't dead, so this can't be poison. Exactly what Remus was trying to prove. They come back in 15 minutes later, obviously not guilty. That's going to be their determination. Remus is still alive. And what turns out is that Remus, as he did so many times in his career, he switched different thinking. He used all of his career choices to help him get ahead in the thing that he was doing. He had been a pharmacist, a very successful pharmacist. He knew the antidote for that poison, took it, and he knew it would counterbalance. So he said, you know, if this person's not, if I'm not dead, then you got to let him free. And
it
happened.
It's such a gimmick from fiction, you know,
yes.
that somebody towering like this guy. Well, I shouldn't say towering, because he was referred to as the Napoleon of the bar.
Yeah, he's not small. He was a short guy, but stocky.
Right. Okay. So he's the Napoleon of the bar, but he does loom large.
He does.
And to think that he had the wherewithal to create this, again, beautiful work of fiction in reality, presenting this dramatic case before a jury, drinking poison, but having previously already consumed the antidote.
Yeah, what I tried to do with the book is begin each chapter at least with a very cinematic scene. Because what I did when I was I researched this like a professional historian, used archival sources, but I looked at it as writing the longest screenplay that anybody's ever read. And that was my goal. And so I'm glad that you picked up on those pieces. Remus's story, the reason people say to me, and particularly readers, they come up to me and whisper, "Bob, you made this up, didn't you?" And I'm like, "No, it's real." And there's a love triangle. There's rivers of booze. There's Gatsby-like parties. It's a fun story. And it all happened here. And 90%, 95% of the people from the Cincinnati area and surrounding communities, they've never heard of Remus. And so I thought, with the 100th anniversary of Prohibition, this has to be told.
This love triangle that you just referenced is another component to this story where you think there's no way. There's no way, because ultimately he does go to prison, federal prison in Georgia, for his participation in violations of what was known as the Volstead Act, Prohibition. We can get into some of the bootlegging, of course. We all kind of know what that means. He did build an empire here, but he's in prison and he's talking to someone that he, of course, naturally assumes is a fellow prisoner. But this person turns out to be an informant who is placed there to sort of gather important information about bootleggers. But tell us what this guy ends up doing.
Yeah, the top undercover agent in the Prohibition Bureau is this guy named Franklin Dodge. And he's a big strapping guy, good looking, and he has a way to mimic gangsters. So he gets sent to the best cases all over the country. There's a lot of corruption in Atlanta, so Dodge gets sent to Atlanta to uncover what's going on down there. Well, Remus hears that Dodge might be able to be bribed, and that's one of Remus's specialties, bribing people to get his way. So he sends his wife to meet with Dodge and says, "See if we can't work with him." Well, they meet, and she instantly falls head over heels in love with him. And it was like being thunderstruck. They spend the next 2 years while Remus is in jail, then when he gets out. But Franklin and Imogene spend the next two and a half years spending and hiding his millions.
She has complete control over the fortune that he has accumulated.
Yeah, because when Remus got thrown into prison, most of his high-level lieutenants got sent with him. So he needed somebody on the outside to kind of keep the empire going until he got out, because he never thought that he would stay in prison long, because he had the Harding White House bribed. And they promised him that he would get out soon. But the federal government, they had a different story for Remus, and he ended up staying in. So, yeah, it's crazy. I would love to go down to some resorts in Florida and see if I couldn't track where some of Remus's art went, because supposedly Imogene and Franklin donated it to some racetracks down there. Florida was the only place they could get where Remus had no eyes. He had no spies, and they could go to Florida and buy their own privacy down there.
So with so little known about his story and some like definitive biography, talk about how you went about collecting information and putting this story together and then telling it the way you did.
Well, what I did, I like to do a mix of things. I like to do the Robert Caro walk the ground kind of thing. So with Franklin Dodge, I went to his boyhood home, which is now a museum in Lansing, Michigan. And I stood in his bedroom and I walked around his house and I looked at archives that people don't usually get to see. So there's that component of actually walking the ground. You know, I've walked Eden Park 100 times. I know that route like the back of my hand. And then on top of that, I look at all the resources that I can that exist, archival, newspaper, everything. And thankfully, Charles Taft donated his court transcripts to Yale Law School. So through
my connections. Charles Taft was the prosecutor in the case against
Remus. So Charlie Taft goes up against Dodge, and even though he loses and it destroys his career, he donates the papers. And so reading through those papers, I could see like these angry pencil marks where he would scratch things out. And pulling all these different pieces together, I could get a really good sense of who Remus was. And it really is a cultural history in addition. I think you learn a lot about Prohibition and the times and Cincinnati and the region and Cincinnati and it's Cleveland, Chicago, a lot of the areas that I talk about. So it's a mix of walking the ground and putting the archives together and then just trying to tell a good story.
Well, many people have walked the grounds of Eden Park, and there's sort of a climactic part of this story in his life because he does get out of prison and he does go after his wife and ultimately kills her near the famous gazebo there in the park. Can you set the scene for us? I know that you basically opened the main part of the book with his telling the police,
yeah,
lock me up, I just shot my wife.
Yeah, because he turned himself in. And it's as you read the book, you'll be able to determine how much of this Remus planned in advance. I mean, he definitely planned parts of it in advance. He couldn't get Imogene to talk to him, and he needed money because he needed money to rebuild his army to start the empire back up. And she wouldn't meet with him. She wouldn't have proceedings to split up their money because she wanted it all. So he finally had enough, and he goes and stalks her outside the Alms Hotel, which is still there. It's not a beautiful hotel anymore, but the building is still there. They take off. She gets out, gets into a cab with her daughter, who's about to celebrate her 20th birthday. They speed off down Victory Parkway. They're going to Imogene's divorce attorney. George has his driver run her off the road right by the gazebo. And by the time she gets out of the car, looks back and makes sure her daughter is safe, turns around, she goes to strike him. He grabs her hand. She doesn't see the gun in his right hand, and he sticks it right in her stomach and pulls the trigger. And she dies within probably 5 minutes from that time. It was deliberate, and I think one of the interesting things about this book is there's still a lot of mysteries to be solved. And I don't know, maybe because there won't be a paper trail, if we'll ever get the full explanation, but how much of this George and his henchmen planned ahead of time is a big part of the story. And so the reader can kind of get engaged with that mystery. He definitely pulled the trigger. He definitely killed her. But how much of it was rage? What did he go temporarily insane? Was it all an act? I mean, these are key important stories when you're dealing with criminality.
At the end of his life was not so extravagant.
No, unfortunately for Remus. The one thing I will tell you, a lot of newspaper people said that Remus died poor, and he did not die poor. He married again, believe it or not, and his third wife was a secretary, a very rich woman named Blanche Watson, and she is very mysterious. And one person, if I could go in a time machine, I would want to meet her, because I think she may have been at least 50% of the brains of the operation. And they had money, they had racehorses, but at the end of Remus's life, he has a stroke. And so he was in the hospital for about 9 months, and then he was bedridden for another 6 months or so before he passed away. So Blanche had always owned the two houses, and you can go see them, 808 and 810 Greenup in Covington. They're still there, so you can see them. They bounced back and forth. She owned the houses decades before they ever lived there. But they were like her safety valve. She had her family members living there, things like that. And he ended up dying there under a nurse's care. But he wasn't penniless, like journalists say. They had plenty of money.
And he's buried in Falmouth.
He is. That's you can go see the grave. The one thing that I do wish, and maybe the reason, circling back to your first question, why Remus isn't better known, is that Blanche and George, kind of in a big Ponzi scheme, had the house torn down, the great Gatsby-like mansion in 1934. If that mansion would have stuck around, maybe some of the legend would have stuck around as well.
That's very interesting. I may have jumped around a bit, but we're talking about him marrying again after killing his wife.
Yeah.
I know that there's some to be read in the book, and there's reason for people to read it or to come to your presentation on Thursday, but why didn't he face the music on killing his wife?
Well, because he was a criminal genius and he was a legal genius. I mean, he was legitimately one of the top three criminal defense attorneys in America before he became a bootlegger. And he knew, because he had used the same game plan earlier in his career to get a guy who murdered his wife off the death sentence. The guy still went to jail, but he didn't get the electric chair. Remus knew that he had a plan, and he followed that plan defending himself. And for some reason, the judge let him. There are surviving documents. William Howard Taft told his son, Charlie, don't do it. Don't let Remus speak to the public. Don't let him do his hijinks, because he was internationally famous as a lawyer. And Remus did everything that William Howard Taft said he was going to do and beat his son. So that's how he got off. It took him about six months afterward. They were so mad they threw him in Lima in the state criminally insane asylum. But he eventually, the Ohio Supreme Court said, you can't do this. He should be free. And so he gets let loose, he gets to marry again, gets to live another 20 years. So it's crazy. You can't talk about it. We could be here all day and we'd never go over.
I mean, your presentation is scheduled for 2 hours. The book is a solid read as well, but it's quite a good page turner. And of course, we've been talking about George Remus with author Bob Batchelor, and you're a relatively prolific writer. You've published before and you're publishing again. You have a couple of projects in the works that I want to touch on in our last 90 seconds together. You've got a book coming out about Kobe Bryant, but of more locally interested people, you have a book coming out about Rookwood.
Yeah, this is Rookwood's 140th anniversary year. They were formed in 1880, and Rookwood, like Remus, is a story that more people should know. Mariah Longworth Storer was the first woman to found a manufacturing company in the entire United States. And Rookwood in the early 1900s, was considered about the same way we might think of Nike. It was globally famous. And I meet people today that don't know what Rookwood is. And this is an institution nationally, not just in Cincinnati. I mean, we should be studying this in business schools. I mean, it's particularly yesterday with International Women's Day. Mariah is a hero. She's a hero for what she was able to accomplish. And so we're doing an illustrated book, 60,000 words, 300 plus illustrations, images, things like that. It's. I think people around Cincinnati are really going to dig the book.
I hope you'll come back and talk to us about that too.
Definitely.
And I would bet there are a couple of Rookwood fireplace tiles or something in the homes on the 800 block of Greenup Street in Covington.
Yes.
Where this story concludes, The Bourbon King, The Life and Crimes of George Remus, Prohibition's Evil Genius. There's an event hosted by the Campbell County Public Library at the Syndicate in Newport on Thursday. Details at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Our guest has been the author of that book, Bob Batchelor. Bob, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. And I'm Michael Monks.